Okay, Boker Tov, everybody. I think we can get started. Nice to see everybody, even those who I don't see. And
sorry, I'm behind the
telephone. No, it's fine. And what you know, if you want to turn on, as Rabbi Pearl yet mentioned, yes, it's always good. All the speakers always like when cameras are on, but it's okay. Do what you're comfortable with. And all right. So we're in the last Mishnah. We're gone in the middle of the last Mishnah of the fourth, you know, Perek. That we discussed last week, sort of on the surface, a depressing Mishnah. We're all going to die. We're all going to have to give judgment. But on the other hand, an uplifting Mishnah. The fact that God, you know, judges us is because he cares about us. The animals don't get judged. You don't care about what your neighbor's, you know, kid does. You care about your kid. You discipline your kid. You don't discipline somebody else's kid. So the fact that we're judged and all that is not judging to give, you know, punishment. We discuss how the jail system is supposed to work in theory. It doesn't work that way in practice. But, you know, a punishment is not really meant. Well, actually, Rabbi Jaffe spoke about that last week in the Parsha Shir. What capital punishment? Is it a punishment, or is it a deterrent, or is it really a way to improve? But I think most of the way in the Torah view of thing, I think the primary view is that when we're judged, it's to improve us. We give lashes. So today, you know, that's considered, you know, we would barbaric. I don't know what the word is, but we know there's the whole Masechet in the Talmud giving a person, you know, Yimakot, to give him lashes for 207 of the 365 sins. If it's a negative commandment that doesn't have a death penalty and that involves an action, so you get lashes. So the Mishnah, the Rambam lists off 207 of the 365. Of course, in practice, like a lot of these things, it often wasn't done, but the truth of the matter is getting lashes was considered a positive thing. Why? Because it freed you from further punishment. That's how the sages understood it. So, for example, let's say you eat on Yom Kippur. So that's a pretty serious sin. That's one of the 36 sins of Karait. There are 36 sins in the Torah. You're cut off from your people. You sort of, you know, everybody sins. But to do certain sins mean I don't identify as a Jew. Eat chametz on Pesach. How can a Jew eat chametz on Pesach? That's the founding of the Jewish people. You don't have a brit milah. They're the only two positive mitzvot. 34 of the 36 are negative. You did something wrong. Two of them, if you don't do something right, you get karet. So that's a brit milah, circumcision, and we don't have any more, but bringing the korban Pesach, because those are the national identity markers. Thank God today, I don't know, 98% of Jews, at least in Israel, it's probably 99.9% get a brit milah. So those are the big sins. The big sins you get karet. The violating the laws of Shabbat, okay, whatever. So the Mishnah says that if you violated a sin of karet, we give you lashes, but the lashes exempt you from the karet. Whatever karet means, that you'll die young, you lose your share in the world to come. Well, that's not our issue now. It's unclear, obviously. But Torah says you are benichra too. You're cut off from the Jewish people by getting lashes, which isn't so pleasant. That absolves you from the punishment of karet. And that's why, there is a custom. It's written in the Shulchan Aruch. I don't know, on Erev Yom Kippur, you ask the gabbai in the shul to give you lashes. Whether that counts exactly is a whole different story, because it's not going to give you the real lashes with the way it's described in the Mishnah. But there was, that's what some, I believe that's what some of the people say, why, when, you know, there were two attempts to reestablish a Sanhedrin in the 16th century after the expulsion of Spanish, like Jewry, to reestablish a real Sanhedrin that can reinterpret laws of the Torah, that can change laws of the Talmud, that has tremendous power. The Sanhedrin had tremendous power and to give, you know, punishment when needed. So there was an attempt in the 16th century, and there was an attempt in 1948 with the creation of the State of Israel. Yehuda Lev Maimon, the first real minister of religion. I think I mentioned this once, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, the first shiur I heard of Rav Lichtenstein when I was in the Gross Kollel at YU, was on this topic. We learned Masechet Sanhedrin. There was, I don't know, it was the first year, but he spoke about the reestablishing a Sanhedrin in our time. So one of the, I believe, one of the impetuses for establishing a Sanhedrin in the 16th century was that many of the Jews who secretly converted, or not secretly, who publicly converted to Christianity and secretly practiced Judaism, which I'm not, God forbid, judging anybody, but they felt they had violated a serious sin, which they sort of did. And on a on paper. You know, you're not supposed to convert in public. That's one of the three big sins, that you're not supposed to convert, even at the pain of death. So many of these people wanted atonement. They realized they did something wrong, so they wanted to get lashes, but they could only get lashes if there was a Sanhedrin. So that's an interesting idea. So we don't think like that. I don't think modern people think like this. But anyways, that's all just say that the punishment in the Torah is not meant as punishment. It's meant as a way to improve. Yes, we have that notion that Yisurim, when suffering, Yisurim shel Ahava. We have that concept that God sometimes makes us suffer out of love, although I think it's very important to point out what Rabbi Yochanan said. You know, I can do without the suffering. I can do without the love. Leave me alone. You know, get somebody else to love with the suffering. Of course, because that's how a normal human being reacts. So yeah, this is obviously a difficult, sensitive, tricky topic. But and for sure, I think modern sensitivities are perhaps like different or not perhaps are different than in the time of the Talmud in the Middle Ages, etc. But anyways, the fact that God judges us should be seen as very, very positive and very uplifting. Okay, so let's finish up the Mishnah. So we're towards the end of the Mishnah, and the last thing I did, I believe, that hakolafi hacheshbon, that everything is judged, no, one by one. The sin doesn't cancel out the mitzvah doesn't cancel out the sin. You get the punishment for the sin and reward for the mitzvah. It's not like, oh, I did a mitzvah, therefore I get rid of the sin. There are two independent things. The only thing that gets rid of the sin is tshuva. When I repent and I don't do the sin, and I use it as a springboard to be better. So I don't think, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think I mentioned the Tiferet Yisrael, what he said last week. And if I did, okay, we'll review that. Basically, sins are subjective. And of course, there's an objective standard. I just told you there's 36 sins the Torah considers so severe they are correct. But we know there's a subjectivity to them. And for example, I think eating on Yom Kippur is viewed today as very, very serious. It's violating the Shabbat is viewed not so serious. And to take another one of the karets, that's having relations with a woman who is a nida. That for sure, like who viewed that? That should be one of the primary sins in Judaism. So there's a subjective way of looking at it, or to go to the other way, intermarriage. So we consider, our attitudes towards intermarriage have changed also. I think that's a good thing, but we have a much more sort of understanding attitude and welcoming attitude, and maybe we should bring them in. That's not our discussion here. My point is, we know that intermarriage is viewed as, has been viewed as sort of, that's it, you know, you're out. And even if we don't throw them out, when they intermarry, their kids aren't going to be Jewish. 98% of them aren't going to be Jewish, for sure, their grandchildren. It's just the way it works. But intermarriage in the Torah is at most a negative commandment. I don't mean to minimize it, but it's like one of the 200. It's not like a no karet. It's even questionable whether there's a biblical prohibition. Some the Torah writes, I know this is like, they don't teach you this because this would be like astounding. The Torah, the medieval code, the Arbiturim of Yaakov, the son of the Rosh, Germany, 14th century. So he wrote the code, which the Shulchan Aruch used as his basis to write his code. He just sort of followed his template. The Torah, I believe, writes intermarriage is only a rabbinic prohibition. The biblical prohibition is in the seven nations dwelling in the land of Israel. If you look in Parshat Beit Hanan, when we read, "Velo tithatein bam," not to marry them, the Torah is specifically talking about the seven nations in the land of Israel. So many extend that. Those were the seven nations at that time. Today, it's other people. Fine. It's still a biblical prohibition. But others say, no, the biblical prohibition is the seven nations. So the rabbis, of course, it's not a good idea to intermarry. But we clearly, the way we view mitzvot and avirot is not connected necessarily to the severity of it. Clearly, intermarriage has social implications, and the Rambam writes, in many ways, it's worse. Who cares that technically it's only this and that? We know we can't, we're not only technical. There are social implications, historical implications, and that's what the Tiferet Yisrael is pointing out. We have done a mitzvot and a veira too. God doesn't just look at the severity of the sin. The two things he mentioned was that how much joy you get out of a sin, the more joy you get out of sinning when you know it's wrong. Then it has to be worse. And it also has to, how big your Yetzer Hara is. Some people have certain inclinations, let's say, to get, you know, controversial, whatever. I don't know. Someone who is gay. I don't, in other words, we can understand if they violate what it technically says in Torah, because the other people are not gay, don't have such inclination to sin. So somebody would say, no, I just want to experience that because I want to experience everything in life. So that's much, much worse than someone who's gay, and it's a whole different story. So how we judge people and how serious the sin is depends on many factors. The other hand, the Meshech Chochmah has a beautiful idea that I may have mentioned in the past, last year perhaps. The Meshech Chochmah, Rav Meir Simcha of Divinsk, he died in 1926, I believe, wrote a commentary on the Rambam, the Or Sameach, and then wrote what we call the Meshech Chochmah. I mentioned Rabbi Cooperman from Michlala, those who went to Michlala. No, that was his magnum, the main work he did in his life was writing a 3-volume critical edition of the Meshech Chochmah. Meshech Chochmah was a Zionist. He said the Balfour Declaration was the Gimel Shvuah, that it gave permission for the Jews against our historical notion that we have to wait for the Mashiach ended with the Balfour Declaration. Anyways, so the Meshech Chochmah has a beautiful comment. I think it's a beautiful comment. Maybe you'll agree or disagree that the famous Midrash, there are various Midrashim. There is no one Midrash that says we were redeemed from Egypt because we didn't change our names, clothes, and language. Those things appear in various Midrashim. I forget now who pointed it out to me. There is no Midrash that says that, even though everybody quotes that, including great rabbinic figures. You look in the sources, one Midrash says they didn't change their names and their language. The other one says they didn't change their clothes. Another one says they didn't speak Lashon Hara, whatever it was. But the Meshech Chochmah commenting on that, knows what's such a big deal. My name is, you know, Jay. I don't call myself, you know, Tzvi Yehuda. My Hebrew name is, Tzvi Yehuda, but I was brought up as Jay, and that's what I call myself, Rav Schechter told us once, there was some guy who wanted to convince everybody should go by Hebrew name. After all, we were redeemed because we didn't change our name. So Norman Lamb, he went to Norman Lamb, he should be Nachum Lamb. And he said, no, his name is Norman Lamb. And that's how I was called. That's how my parents named me. I have a Hebrew name. My kids have Hebrew names. That's a different generational idea. So what's so important? And Rav Moshe Feinstein has that true, but you don't have to have a Hebrew name. Look, I mean, it's nice, of course, but there's no prohibition to give your kid an English name. Look in the Talmud. You have rabbis who had names of their Babylonian culture, and you have all these Greek and influences, so what does the Meshech Chochmah says? The Meshech Chochmah says that you have to know when you're living, where you're living. You have to know your social circumstances. Today, who you don't, it's not so important to have a Jewish name. I have a mezuzah on my house. I keep kosher. I keep Shabbos. So that's how I have my Jewish identity. But in Egypt, there was no Shabbos. There was no mezuzah. There was no kashrut. There wasn't any of this. So the only way to keep your Jewish identity was through a Jewish name. And through speaking Hebrew. So that became such an important mitzvah. The importance of mitzvah change over time. It sort of sounds, if someone has like a classical Orthodox education, that sounds like almost heresy, but it's obviously so true. Obviously the mitzvah itself doesn't change, but the historical importance of the mitzvah change. So in Egypt, changing your name. That's why I always say sometimes the Magen David on some kid on a college campus, can make all the difference in the world. Something inspired them. We should never, sometimes the smallest things become the biggest things. Okay. Anyway, so that's the idea that Hakol Lefi Cheshbon. That's what the Tiferet Yisrael says. God judges. When's Kol Cheshbon? It says in the Torah, you do this and you get this punishment. No. Because you have to look at so many factors. You have to look at your personal situation. You have to look at the social factors. You have to look at the historical factors. As a matter of fact, Rav Soloveitchik says that's our claim to tshuva. How we come to God, Rosh Hashanah tshuva. What do you mean tshuva? You did wrong. It says, God, you made me born. I was born in North America. Okay, I was born in Canada, but America, and in the 20th century, what do you expect me to do with the culture that's out there? It's impossible for me not to sin. I'd have been born in the shtetl in Poland. Of course, I'd be an observant Jew because that's all there was. So Rav Soloveitchik says that's a legitimate claim that somebody can make, that obviously the greater the temptations, we're human beings. And the Gemara has expression of that. If you put somebody in front of a brothel and you just put them there, you leave your 20-year-old kid there, well, what do you think is going to happen? And you can't always blame, you know, yes, on a certain level, of course, but our claim to tshuva is God. There's so many external factors working upon us. So we don't know the exact calculations. How much of it is our fault, external? Obviously, it's a combination of both. And obviously, we're supposed to rise above our external factors. But we know that's not always humanly possible. And that's fine. And God understands that. And that's how tshuva can happen. That's really how Rav Soloveitchik explained. Okay. So that's how kol lefi cheshbon. Everything is judged, you know, with so many factors involved. So then the Mishnah continues. Al yiftecha, this is the second half, the last Mishnah in the fourth chapter. Al yiftecha yitzrach shehashol beit manoslach. Don't let your inclination fool you, or promise. Yiftecha shehashol, that the grave is your refuge. You know, I'm going to die. Who cares? Once I'm dead, nothing can happen. That's all over. That don't think like that. Shal korchacha tanotzar, because you're born against your will. We'll discuss that in a moment. But korchacha tanolad, and you atanotzar means you are conceived. It's interesting, the Mishnah. So you were conceived against your will. Matter of fact, Rashi comments, we say it now in Ladavid, ki avi ve'imi yazvuni, right? We say in the David, my father and my mother left me. What's the rest of the pasuk? I don't remember because I'm not in the David mode, or I can look it up. And God will collect me. Thank you very much, Debbie. Thank you. So I believe Rashi on that pasuk says, it's a very, you know, can't teach this in elementary school. Rashi says that while you were being conceived, your parents were having a good time. Your parents weren't thinking about conceiving you. Your parents have even me. They don't care. They just want to have some fun. And it's an unbelievable comment, right? You're born against your will. You have nothing to what you think your parents brought you in the world. Of course, it's not even totally true. But it's an amazing comment. You were conceived against your will. And you were born against your will. It's interesting. The Mishnah says
it's not really against your will. Al korchacha is not against your will. Al korchacha means nobody's asking you.
I don't think so, but I'm willing. If you can bring me other evidence, I'm happy to hear. Korcha, bal korcho means you force somebody. But that's throughout the Talmud. Whenever the Mishnah, al korcha means you're being forced, right? I'm pretty sure that's how it's always used, but I'd be happy to hear examples of where that isn't true. But and it's also, I think, in the context of the Mishnah, it's talking about you think you know, you can escape it. Whether you want to or not, we're going to judge you. So I think, but thank you. Al korchata nolad, al korchata cha, you live against your will, and that's clearly, we'll see how the commentaries understood it. Ba'korchach atameid, and you die against your will. Ba'korchach, the word over and over again. That's like the theme of the Mishnah. That's milam manoach. Ata atid latid leitein din v'cheshvon. You're going to have to give a judgment and an accounting. Bifnei melech malchei hamlachim hakadosh baruch hu, before the King of Kings, the Holy One, blessed be he. Okay, it's a very, just the language is powerful, even if you don't know what it means. You can see there's something serious here. and the way that this is the end of the chapter. The chapter ends before the God, Melech Malchei Hamlachim HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's like a real, we don't just say before Hashem. Like that's how we want to really explain how the greatness of God. And that's how the chapter ends. So let's see, let's start. Okay, born against our will. Okay. So of course, we don't have any say, so I want to discuss very briefly. The Gemara has a debate, Beit Sham, I'm sure many people are aware of this, a relatively famous debate between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. Noach lo la'adam shenivra. Is it good that we were born or not? And of course, and Beit Shammai says no. What do you expect? Beit Shammai is going to say no, and Beit Hillel is going to say yes. You know, Beit Hillel had a much more positive, upbeat attitude, and Beit Shammai was different. They had a different, it's like Nevardik and Slabatka, you know, the Musar schools. You know, one of the very, man is great, is wonderful, is creating the image of God. In other words, man's a sinner and nobody, you got to improve. You know, it's different. Different people have different approaches. So the Beit Hillel approach, life is wonderful. Life is great. And Beit Shammai, what are you talking about? Life is miserable. Look what's going on in the world. And so Noach Lo would have been better not to be born. So for 2.5, it's a very depressing. Like no, you come across this. This is in A or B in 13B. It's right after the discussion of why we follow the view of Beit Hillel and not Beit Shammai. It's in that same discussion there. So the Talmud, after 2.5 years, they are, you don't have that by their other arguments. When an egg is born on Yontif, they also argue if you can eat it, but it doesn't say they argue for 2.5 years whether you can eat an egg born on Yontif, you know, like they didn't, obviously, who, you know, but the deep philosophical questions of life. So they argued for 2.5 years. And the Talmud says, you know what happened after 2.5 years? They came to the conclusion, you know what? They agreed. It would have been better had we not been born. But now that we're born, we have no choice. God didn't ask us. Our parents didn't ask us. So examine your deeds and do good. So that Tosfot off points out, well, then it makes it good if you were born. In other words, it would have been better, but now that you're born, examine your action. Because someone who's a tzaddik, it's the average person. The average person sins a lot. He doesn't do such wonderful things. So for him, it would have been better not to be born. But for someone who's righteous, would have been better. Someone who's righteous, it would have been better he was born. So that's how that argument is generally understood. I'm now going to say I think that's totally incorrect interpretation of that argument. I don't know totally, but that's not what they're arguing about. And look at the word. It doesn't say tovlo shenivra. It's a good. It was a good for a man to be great. It's tov or ra. That's not the language. It's noach. What does noach mean? Comfortable. Is it comfortable for man to be created? Of course it was good. It's heresy to say it wasn't good. Vayar Hashem, calling Asher Asav, Inei Tov Mo'ot. God saw everything he did. It was wonderful. What do you mean? That's the whole story of Bereshit, is God created a beautiful world. How can, and I believe it's heresy to say that it's bad to be born. The Torah says it. That's the first message of we're created in the image of God. How can being created in the image of God be bad? Of course, we can mess up, of course. That's not the debate, Tov or Ra. Noach, is it comfortable? Life is not about comfort. It's not comfortable. Life is messy. And sometimes life is going to be unpleasant. That doesn't mean it was bad for you. It's good for you morally, but it's bad for you, you know, in practice. A person, God forbid, is sick and suffering and all kinds of terrible tragedies go on in the world. It's not Noach. But that doesn't mean it wasn't good. It's a very important distinction. I don't know any other people who pointed out really, but it's clear. Just look in the Gemara and Eruvin. It doesn't say, how can it say it wasn't good? That's what the Torah says. It was good.
Right.
God created a wonderful world. And then they said, I missed one point. I mean, not exactly, but you know what? It's not good to be alone. Correct. It's good. It's good, but it's not good if you're alone. I have to complete the process. Excellent, right? But of course it's good to have been created, and for sure then if you're married then 100%, right? Lo tov ayot levado aselo. It's noach lo, and that of course we Rav Soloveitchik loved this theme idea. You know, we discussed many times, but it's always worth repeating. Yaakov Avinu, right? Bikesh leishev b'shalva vayeshev Yaakov beretz migurei aviv. Yaakov has had a tough life. He's 91. He had a brother who threatened to kill him. He had to run away from home. He never saw his mother again. His mother made him, you know, he felt terrible. His mother made him trick his father, and then he had to run away, and he never saw his mother again. She died in the interim. And he gets mistreated in Laban, and he gets fooled in his life and problems. It's a real messy life. It's a messy life. And he comes back, and though he's 91 years old, his father's still alive. He comes back by Yeshev Yaakov Beretz Migurei Aviv Beretz Knan, and great. Beikesh Leishev B'Shav. He wanted to retire. He's 91. Time to retire. Live out my life in comfort. Rugzo, I forget the anger of God came to him. Yaakov Avinu. I'm sorry.
Kapatzalav.
Kapatzalav, thank you very much. Without the right, thank you. Kapatzalav, Rogzo, Shalakadosh Baruch Hu. God, like, jumped on him. Kapatz. God was angry at him. How dare you say that? What do you mean, rest?
Rogzo, Shalaysav. Rogzo, Shalaysav.
I'm sorry? No. Okay, I have to look. I don't know. thank you. I'll take a look. But got angry at him and said, this world is not the place for resting. This is not Noah. We don't sit and relax. That's what the next world is for. But in this world, so it's we're born against our will. And it's sometimes being born is very uncomfortable. And sometimes people, unfortunately, have very, very tragic lives. Sometimes people have wonderful lives. But it doesn't mean it's the Noach. The debate is Noach. So Shammai says, you know what? With all the problems, who needs it? It's kind of like what Hillel, not the famous Hillel of this Hillel. There's a later Hillel in the fourth century, the one who established our calendar in the year 359, the calendar that we use today, Lo'ad Rosh, the Rosh Hashanah can never be on a Sunday, Wednesday, or Friday, the first day. Our 19-year cycle calendar was established in the fourth century by Hillel, Rabbi Hillel, not the Hillel of Shammai. So he's the one who said, you know, Yemot HaMashiach, I don't need that. That's not for me. I don't want to be alive, because in the Messianic era, there's going to be tumult and turnover and wars and Gog and Magog, and who's, you know, I'm happy to live in a different era. I'm happy to live when it's quiet. I want a Noach life. But right. And by the way, I always comment that maybe, you know, Noach, the person Noach, that's why he's not the first Jew, because he's Noach. Noach was a tzaddik ish tamim haya b'torah tav. Halavai, the Torah should say that about me and you, that Noach was a great guy, and everybody, you know, destroys Noach, what he did wrong. Noach was a great guy. He was a tzaddik. He wasn't an Abraham, and he didn't merit to be the first Jew. Okay, but he was still a great, great, great person, but because he was Noach. After the flood, it was too hard to rebuild. Who can blame him? He got drunk. I don't know. You're going to blame the guy, you know? So, but that's it. He wanted a rest, and he had enough of life. He saved the world. He did enough. He let him live out the rest of his life in peace. Noach, that's his name. And then Abraham is Lech Lecha. Get out of here. Go. That's how we meet Abraham. Lech Lecha Me'artzecha Me'olad Lecha. So this is the idea. Noach lo shalom nivra, or not. Yes. But interesting, Hillel says it is comfortable that we were born. In other words, Shammai's Noach lo shalom, that's a debate. So the conclusion, you know, overall, life isn't always so comfortable. Of course, it's not a empirical discussion, talking conceptually. Okay, that's just an important point. I hope you found that interesting. Okay, yes.
I looked up Al Kochacha and Bemet Jastro. I looked up in Safaria. Mm-hmm. He brings both against your will and nobody's asking you. So it's
okay.
Samantha.
Okay, thank you. Could be both. Okay, thank you very much. I think in this context, though, it's pretty clear it's against your will, just the whole context of the Mishnah. But yes, okay, great, great. Al Korchacha at Chai, we sometimes have against your will. So the Bartanura says like a very modern comment. A modern comment, I think, of medical ethics. It says sometimes people want to die. They're suffering and they want to die. And they can't die. And what do you mean they can't die? They're not allowed to kill themselves, whatever. People, you know, the whole issue, end of life issues. People, you sometimes live against your will sometimes. You know, that's, we've discussed that the Ran quotes, you're allowed to pray that a sick person should die. That's totally acceptable. I know it sometimes goes against the way modern people think, but that's the Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was suffering and the students were praying he should die and the maidservant broke a dish. And they all stopped for a second, you know, the noise it jolted them, and that's when he died. And the commentaries say the maidservant was right and the students were wrong. You don't pray for someone who's suffering to continue living. You can pray, you can actually, but you can't pull the plug. I'm not getting into all the medical, and come to our medical conferences. We discuss these issues, but I'm not discussing, you know, what he do in modern times and all the technologies, but you can pray. That's what the commentaries say. And I know it's sometimes that the Tehillim they say for people is really wrong. You really, you'd say Tehillim, they should, you know, die, not that they should live. I know that sounds harsh, and I don't necessarily mean, I just want to stress the point that we don't always pray for someone to live, but that's what the Mishnah is saying, where we sometimes live against our will, we want to die, and of course often we die against our will. People don't want to die and they die. So that's what the Mishnah says. We're going to have to give an accounting, and I always like I believe it's the Vilna Gaon who said it, what's the difference between a din and a cheshbon? I'm going to have to give a din, a judgment, and a cheshbon is like math, you know, in modern Hebrew, and an accounting, right? So he says a din is what you did wrong. You have to pay for your sins. A kol lefi cheshbon, God is going to judge you every action, good and bad. And the word, the din is here for the negative, and cheshbon is for the good you could have been done instead of the negative. In other words, instead of talking Lashon Hara, I could have learned Torah. So it's like a double whammy. I spoke Lashon Hara, got to get whacked for that one. And then I didn't learn Torah. That's double. So it's a very, in other words, it's a beautiful point. When we do something wrong, it's not that we do something wrong. It's we're not doing something right. Because we could be using that energy to do something right. So, and yeah, we're doing wrong. So it's a double sin. Every time we sin, it's a double, double negative, which is not a positive. Let's say it's not mathematically correct.
Increases the assets and increases the liabilities. Correct?
Okay. Talking as an accountant, like I used to be in my olden life. And, okay. Very good. Yes. The assets and liabilities. Yeah. We're going to give judgment before the King of Kings. And this, of course, reminds us the famous story of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai on his deathbed. Blessed his students asked him for a blessing, and he said, you should fear God as much as you fear man. And they were all disappointed. Rabbi, like, please, I learned that in kindergarten. Give me something. Give me a pshat in the Gemara so I can understand a difficult Tosfot. Like, well, didn't you tell me this stuff to fear God? He said, halavai, if only you would fear God as much as you feared man. Boy, and he's talking to Rav Eliezer HaGadol and Rav Yoshua and, the five students of Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai that formed the second pair Pirkei Avot. These are the people he's talking to. Yeah, you guys, you fear man more than you fear God. It's, fearing God is like such a hard mitzvah, one of the hardest mitzvot. And I guess the way to do it, I'll quote, we had it in 2 weeks ago, right? Vata Hashem, Ta Yisro Ma Hashem Shoal Mimach. Right, Moshe Rabbeinu Nekev, what does God want from you? Kim, not too much. God, here's what God wants, very little. Kim li rat Hashem, you just have to fear God. So Gemara says, that's it? What do you mean? That's all. Is it milta zuta? Is it a small thing? It's a tremendous thing. It's really hard. Well, what do you mean? So the Gemara gives this really weird answer. It says, in legabe Moshe, milta, for Moshe, it's no big deal. Yeah, if you are in the presence of God, if you spoke God to God, when you see greatness, you're awe, you're inspired. For Moshe Rabbeinu, fear of God was no big deal. That's what the Gemara says. So Moshe said to the Jewish people, God, here's what, all you have to do, no big deal, just fear God. It's very nice, but you know what? We can't, what, you look at the Gemara. So J.J. Schefter, remember he told them, what do you mean? Is Moshe Rabbeinu so out of touch with the people? The Torah wasn't written for Moshe Rabbeinu, it was written for us. Right? A failing leader is one who doesn't understand the people. That's why some professors, some people, they're on such a high level, they can't understand people. We know that very usually great, great athletes make lousy coaches because they're so good, they can't understand. It's natural. And they don't understand. I mean, obviously, everybody at the pro level is excellent. But still, the superstars usually are not the best coaches. The best coaches are the journeyman Al Arbor, the New York Islanders. You know, he was a lousy defenseman. But he was a great coach, you know, and because they understand the work ethic. So sometimes great people are out of touch. So is that what we want to say on Moshe Rabbeinu? Yeah, for Moshe, it was no big deal. But the Torah is not for Moshe. So the truth of the matter is it is true a little bit. Moshe was a little out of touch with the people. Aaron was in touch with the people. That's why when Aaron died, Kol Beit Yisrael cried for 30 days, men, women, children. Moshe died 7 days. The men, you know, they had problems with Moshe. Because that was the role. That's why we need Moshe and Aaron. Moshe was the man of truth, but the world is a world of falsehood. So a man of truth in the world of falsehood doesn't mix so well, doesn't drive. So Moshe Rabbeinu was slightly out of touch with the people a little bit. I remember someone, I forget who, years ago, listening to a shir, the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu, I mean, this is more complex. You have to look at it. It was Moshe. God called him up. How can he go up for 40 days and Mount Sinai 7 weeks after they leave Egypt? They've left Egypt. What is it that the leader can't do? You know, after you've been the leader for 10 years, you can leave the people for 2 months. A rabbi starts a new job in a shul. I mean, this is even like a bad example. But, and 7 weeks later, he goes away for 40 days. Don't tell me. He goes to learn in Kolo for 40 days after 7 weeks. Well, that's crazy. So, right. So Moshe Rabbeinu didn't have that connection, but still, still, Moshe Rabbeinu was talking to people. So Rabbi J.J. Schechter said, "In legabe Moshe." Regarding Moshe, it was good. So he had a beautiful idea that in legabe Moshe means, yes, if you're in the presence of Moshe, fearing God is not, legabe doesn't mean regarding Moshe, you're at legabe, you're next to. So if you want to fear God, surround yourself by great people. It's really hard to fear God. How do you fear God? Go to an important, you know, if you're going to hang out on the, you know, wherever, you're not going to fear God. If you're going to hang out with people who are great people, that's inspiring. I mean, I think Rev Lichtenstein spoke about that once, you know, just, you know, their teachers are just inspiring. Like you just, you know, you come out of a shir, you come out of a tshuva shir, and if you listen in, you know, out of Rav Soloveitchik, people came out of those shirim after 4 hours. They were like so inspired. Forget anything what he said, which was mind-boggling, but just the inspiration of somebody, you felt you were in a different world. And sometimes we feel that, I hope, like after Yom Kippur, you know, you spend 25 hours in shul and davening and and you come out, there's a certain sense of closeness to God. It goes away, unfortunately, quickly, but like it's very hard to maintain that, then we're human beings. But if you want to maintain it, so in legabe Moshe, if you want to be lifnei melech malchei hamlachim, to fear kim lirat Hashem, that's all you have to do, fear God. So be with great people. So Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai's message is, halavai, the message I leave you on my deathbed is you should fear God as much as man. The greatest rabbis have difficulty with this. And sometimes, you want to mute yourself, sometimes, because you're a great rabbi, you have heart. I don't have to tell you. That's what we've discussed a number of times. The Netziv discussed this a lot. Great people tend to be arrogant. They have what to be arrogant about. So arrogance and fear of God don't go well together, right? Arrogance, you bloat your own self. So often it's specifically great rabbis who have problems in fear of God. I don't think that's a novel idea. The truly great rabbis can go above that, but you know, great people, they you have to have, that's what the Gemara says, Talmud Chacham has to have a shminit of a shminit, an eighth of an eighth of gava, an eighth of an eighth of arrogance, because if you don't have any arrogance, you're not going to assume greatness. If you think you're a nobody, you'll become a nobody. You have to, what they said in Slabatka, I alluded to before. You do have to have a certain sense that I'm great and I can do it and I don't care. There is that certain swagger that great people all have. So how do you balance that swagger with fear of God is very difficult. And that's the message the chapter is ending off. That's always the concluding message of the chapter. And that's the idea that Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai wanted to leave his students with on is that sometimes the simplest things are the hardest things to do. Okay, I think that brings us to the end of the fifth perek, and now the fourth perek, and now we can start perek hamishi. So that's pretty good. We spent, I don't know, how many weeks? About 20 weeks. I think we started on the last mission in the third perek back in April, and here we are in August, and we did a perek. Okay, good. We went faster last year. I don't know. I went too quickly. I have to go over and slow down. Okay, let's begin the fifth perek. In 10 sayings, the word was created. So I guess what we'll do today, and I'm sure that's all we'll do, is we'll give an introduction to the fifth parak without actually getting to the first Mishnah. The fifth parak is the Mishnah of numerology, numbers, 10. Asara Mamarot, God created the world in 10 sayings, 10 generations from Adam from Noah, 10 tests, the Jewish people tested God in the desert. 10 miracles were done. 10 things were created Erev Shabbos, 10, 10, 10, 10. And then we get to 7. 7 things in a fool and 7 things in a wise person, 7 types of punishment, etc. And then we get to the fours. There are 4 types of people, then 4 types of people who get stuck, and 4 types of people, and 4 types of students, and 4 types of teachers. You get 4, 4, 4. You go 10, 7, 4. This is the Mishnah of numbers. So we know that in the Torah, numbers, of course, are ideas. Numbers are not just numbers. I mean, again, I'm not a math guru. I got to ask my son. But, you know, in the Middle Ages, math and philosophy were in the same department in university. All the great mathematicians were philosophers. I just find that a fascinating idea, because mathematics is a philosophy. Somebody who's not up on math, you would think that's the furthest thing from philosophy. Philosophy is all about ideas and subjectivity and thinking and arguing, and math is the most rigid discipline, you know, but it's not true. And mathematics is a philosophical construct of how the world works. And I guess that's why always the great universities and the great mathematicians were all philosophers. Today, I don't know if that's true as much, but I'm sure it's not in the same department. And I don't know if any of the mathematicians are great philosophers, but it's clear how the Torah, I think, had such a view. And numbers represent ideas. We all know that. So seven is a cycle, the complete cycle, the 7 days of creation. And of course, the seventh month becomes the important month, Rosh Hashanah, the seventh year. We're starting Shemitah this year. And after seven cycles of seven, Shavuot, seven times seven. And so seven is, of course, a cycle. 10 is completeness. 10, God created the world in 10 Ma'amarot. The Aseret had the brought, and of course they go together. The Rashi, God created the world for the purpose of the Aseret had the brought. 10 and 10, right? 13 is our relationship to God, the 13 attributes of God, Hashem Hashem Kel Rachum Bechanun, the 13 ways we interpret Torah, because Torah is a description of God. So if Torah is a description of God, the Torah also has to have 13 attributes. So Rabbi Yishmael says 13 ways to interpret sort of the 13 attributes of God, 13 principles of faith of the Rambam, right? These numbers are not coincidental. The Rambam, now, of course, I know Rabbi Yosef Abba, three principles of faith, but the Rambam picked 13. Not as a, well, because, oh, it turns out they're 13 principles of faith. No, he took his principles of faith and made sure to put them into 13 categories. It's the number came first before the idea. And 40 is transformation, right? The fetus born after 40 days become real. The flood transforming the world is 40 days. Mount Sinai getting the Torah is 40 days. Multiplying numbers by 10 and you get like a super idea, right? So 7 turns into 70. 70, if it says completeness, so there's 70 nations of the world. That's the entire world. There's 70 members in a Sanhedrin. That's the representation of the Jewish people. 400 years of the exile in Egypt, 40 times 10, right? 400. That's what, even 400 shkalim that Avraham Avinu paid for the burial place for Sarah, because that was our first getting into the land of Israel. So we had to go 400 years in exile to Egypt before we go to Israel. So our first conquering of Israel, so to speak, Abram has to pay 400 shkalim for the burial plot for Sarah. That exile is also seen by 400 that Laban, when Yaakov Avinu leaves Laban's house, he meets Esav. Esav has 400 soldiers with him, because that's the first exile. Remember, the Brit Ben Haftarim could have been fulfilled through Yaakov and Laban's house. Yoger, Yakiger, Yezarachav, Artholhem, Abdubi, Nuotam, they'll be strangers, God will, they'll be afflicted. That's exactly what Yaakov didn't know, the whole Jewish people. He thought that was it. God told Abram, your servant will be. So maybe that's the forerunner to Egypt. So that also is 400. So numbers, of course, are always ideas. And that's why numbers are very often not exact in the Bible. The Torah fudges its numbers. I know that doesn't sound right, but it's for sure. It's obviously true. It's so true that, but if people don't think about it, I'll just give you a couple examples. So everybody knows that Moshe Rabbeinu was how old when he went to Egypt? It's not, everybody knows because it's a verse in the Torah. How old was Moshe when he went to Egypt? Somebody shout it out.
80.
And how old was he when he died?
120.
So there were 40 years. So what happened in those 40 years? So how long were they in the desert? How long were the Jews in the desert?
40 years.
Oh, it can't be 40. How long did it take from the time that Moshe went to Paro and they left Egypt? The Medrash already says a year.
One year.
So how long were they in the desert for?
40. So it doesn't work.
It doesn't work. Why doesn't, because the Torah doesn't care. The Torah's not a history book. The Torah couldn't care less about this stuff. The Torah always does this, right? The 70 years of exile, those who were at the Rabbi Liebtag's series in the summer, gave a whole shiur on that. It's very hard. Nobody knows how to calculate the 70 years. It wasn't 70 years of exile, 70 years to this, from this guy. You had to fudge the numbers. You had to make It's 70 if you go from here to there. Oh, but that's not really you. But it doesn't matter because the rabbis weren't interested in history. That's we like history. It wasn't that the rabbis, God forbid, are lying or cheating. The Torah is doing it because it's who cares? That doesn't matter if they were in the desert 38 years, 39 years. Who cares? 41 years. So the Torah or the one I like the best. I mean, this is theoretically possible, but, right? How many Jewish men were there between the ages of 20 and 60? So we have two counts, right?
Who 603-550.
There you go. 603-550. Now, why is it 550? 550. So if you look, open up your Chumash Dvarim. Maybe I'll do that now just for some fun. That's, and let's count the number of the tribes, the number in each tribe. So let's go. Bamidbar chapter 1. We read this before Shavuot. Okay, so just listen here. Reuven, 46,500. Shimon, 59,300. Yehuda, 74,600. Yisachar, 54,400. Zulun, 57,400. Ephraim, 40,500. You notice something strange here a little bit? What do you notice?
They're all rounded.
They're all 100. No, they're all rounded. They're all rounded. Now, are you going to tell me, no, that's exact. So we'll get a mathematician here. Give me 11 tribes. We'll see 11. It's 550. So one tribe is rounded to 50. It's probably also rounded. But as a 50, the mathematical probability of having 11 tribes ending with the number 100 is like, I can't pronounce that number. I don't know what that number is in mathematics. You know, it's like 100 to the power of, I don't know what that number is. Now, who misses? So it's God. I skipped them. God was 45,650. Very strange. What was God? What's wrong with them? Why can't they be normal? Why can't they have 100 numbers? So you know what the answer is, of course. Go to Parshat Pinchas. So in Parshat Pinchas, we have a second count. This people don't know as much. 603-550 people know. This is 601-730. 601-730. So let's start counting. Let's see what we have here. 601-730. Why can't I find it? It is Parshat Pinchas, no? Okay, let's go. Here, let's start. Okay, I'm just going to go in the middle. God, they're normal. 40,500. Judah, 76,500. Yisvulun, 60,500. Menashe, 52,700. They're also all rounded up to hundreds. But there's one exception. Who's the exception? Anybody? This is like on Chiton HaTanach. This is like a great question. You're like, I don't know. Who's the exception that doesn't add up to 100?
So, is it Menashe?
No, it's Reuven. It's Reuven, and their number is why doesn't it say here? It's 43,730. So what do you notice right away? Interesting. So what's wrong with Reuven and God? There you go. Why are we counting the people? Why were these counts done?
To distribute land.
Well, why do we have to count twice? Because we didn't know. We had a 40 or 39 or 38 year delay in the middle. So we had to count twice. So Reuben and Gad are the tribes of them. I mean, it's so beautiful. It's such a I love this part of Torah. It's such a beautiful idea how the Torah through numbers just gives you this powerful message. Reuben and Gad, because clearly not all the Shvatim ended up in 100. They're all rounded up. But Reuben and Gad, they round up to 50 and 30. Now, why not both? Why 50 and 30? I have no idea. Why 50? I get. It's like half. I get it. But why is Reuben 30? So it could, I don't know why, but that's just an idea. The power of numbers. You have this all over the place. Danny Sperber in his great book, Minhagei Yisrael, has a whole chapter on numbers and how and halacha, in Kabbalah, which I know nothing about, of course, numbers play a big role. You know, the letter they used to, what are sofrim? What's the word sofrim? They're like the rabbinic sages. So they people who counted the numbers in Torah. How many letters are in the Torah? 305,600. Let's take a Torah. Sofrim counted numbers, letters. That's such a powerful concept. The Sfirot, I didn't mention that, 10, right? And Basara Mamrarot, Nivra Olam, it parallels the 10 Sfirot, like what happened in Shemayim, what happens on earth. So numbers are very much, our ideas. Yes, the numbers are more or less accurate. The Torah's not going to make up numbers. Like if the Torah says that Sarah lived to be 127, she probably lived to be 127, although maybe not. Because what does the Midrash say? Why did Sarah live to be 127? Because Esther was going to be the queen over 127 kingdoms. So now I'm not here. That's another, what's the connection to Sarah and Esther? But you already see them, the number, in other words, the rabbis are already indicating maybe the number is not even accurate. Or 137. So three people died at 137, right? Yishmael died at 137. Kahat died at 137. And Amram died at 137, if I'm not mistaken. So then now, I don't know what 137 is exactly, but I don't know that they all died at 137, but the Torah wants to link their life. If three people in the Torah die at the age of 137, like that's weird. Like, what do you mean they die? Like, that's like crazy. So the Torah obviously wants to link these three people. So there's so much power just reading through the nut. And I don't have to tell you, Bereshit and Noach, I mean, we look at them as genealogy tables, right? But they're also numbers, how long do people live, right? Achanoch, who was taken away, lived 365 years. Now, come on, 365. It's obviously connected to nature and the sun. And what? And you think there are 365 negative mitzvot because they're really 365 negative mitzvot? We know there are 84 billion mitzvot. Nobody, we don't have a count there. The Gemara never tells us. We mentioned the Rambam's not even sure. Who knows? Maybe they're not 613 mitzvot. They're 5 million mitzvot. That's why the Rambam has to write a whole book on why don't I count 99.9% of mitzvot? Why don't they get counted in the 613, 14 limiting principles? There's thousands, but Hilchot Shabbat, they're five mitzvot in Shabbat. We're talking about. So the classification for it's crazy. There are thousands of mitzvot. And yet we have a tradition to limit to 613. Okay. So 613 becomes an important number, but it's not 613. It's 365 and 248. And the Gemara says 365. So it's not that there were, we counted them up and they're 365 mitzvot. No, no, no. There had to be 365 negative mitzvot. Like there had to be 13 principles of faith. So we had to figure out how can we get this to 365 and 248. Well, that's what they thought. The limbs and the body. That's interconnection. These foot are interconnected to another. If you're missing a finger, it's not just you're missing a finger. There's a disfigurement in the body. So it's all numbers are beautiful. So that's the fifth chapter. The fifth chapter is the chapter of numerology. Now, I was thinking, so 10 we know, 7 we know. What's 4? Well, it's very interesting. You don't like, I discussed 13, 40, 70. You know, all these numbers, the hundreds, you know, but the number 4. So, I guess it's clear. I can't think of another place. Well, obviously, we'll get on Pesach Seder, obviously. But there was, what's the canon? Those are the only places where 4, I don't play a role in the Torah. So 4 seems to be a typology, 4 different types. So obviously, where does it come from? The 4 children, obviously, on Pesach. Keneged Arba Banim Dibra Torah. I'm sure the Mishnah, which is based on a Mechilta, that the Keneged Arba Banim is based on an old rabbinic Midrash. And I'm sure the Mishnah is playing off that Midrash. That there are 4, what do you mean there are 4 types of children? There are 18 types. Every child is different. If you have 5 children, there are 5 different types of children. 6 children, but there are, what do you mean 4? But 4 became the number, sort of the standard number to make distinctions. So there are 4 type of people who give tzedakah. There are 4 people type who learn. There are more people. We're kind of going to categorize 4. So 4 becomes a series of how we look, different people. And now I'm going to say something. Maybe you'll think, Rabbi, this is, don't give me this Narishkeit. But I thought, I don't know, maybe it's totally crazy, but you can tell me what you think of it. Perhaps it's related because there are 4 matriarchs and it's the mother who sort of establishes has much more influence on the child. So maybe the 4 parallels they form you, but maybe that's just like crazy. I don't know. And then what's interesting, what we do, so we do 2, 10, 7, 4, and then the parak doesn't end. Then the fascinating, you have a series of what I call the kol, right? Kol ahava sheituya b'davar. All love that is dependent on something else. Kol machloket shilim shemem. Everything that arguments for the sake of him. Kol mezaket rabim. Whoever brings merit to the majority. Kol misheish b'davar. Whoever has three qualities. You have these series of kol. What's kol? Kol is like infinity. That's all inclusive number. 10, 7, 4. And then the Mishnah goes, oh, kol. It's every Mishnah. Look in the Berak, begins with the word kol. You see the beauty, the editing of the Mishnah, which, you know, I mentioned before, the world expert of this is Avi Walfish, who lives in Tekoa. And I'm in the middle of reading his book on Mishnah and Brachot. He did a PhD thesis. It's available online. It's in Hebrew. And he's an American originally, but he does almost all this writing. He has a few articles in English, but most of his writing's in Hebrew. He did his PhD on Masechet Rosh Hashanah and how the Perek is started. It is so beautiful. I love this stuff. The literary analysis of the Mishnah. Before you get the content, just look at how the Mishnah is structured. You get the call, all the numbers, and you get all the numbers, call. And then, I haven't quite figured this out, but by the time we get to the end of the Perek, and hopefully next year, we'll have an answer. Then the Mishnah ends, Yehuda ben Tema Omer. So Yehuda, now, he has two things. His second Mishnah, I get, because when you're 5, you learn Mishnah. When you're 10, you learn, when you're 5, you learn Chumash. 10, you learn Mishnah. 15, you learn Talmud. 18, you get married. 20, so it's a listing of your life cycle, numbers, 5, 18, 30, 40, 50, 80, 90. So you have that idea. But I don't know what they think. As Pani, you should be like a lion and an eagle and a deer. You know, we should be. I don't quite know how that fits. And then it ends Ben Bagbag and Ben Hehe. So I have to figure out what exactly Ben Hehe. I think I figured out. Please God, we can discuss next week. But okay, but that's basically the structure of the fifth pair. Okay. So like I said, we'll do the introduction, and please God, next week we'll get into the pair itself. So just to quickly review. This guy said, "Kol lefich cheshbon, that the sins and mitzvot are dependent on sociological factors, historical factors, personal factors. We can't just look at the technical prohibition. Sometimes what you did is worse than the technical prohibition, and sometimes the technical prohibition may be very severe, but we judge you much less severely because of all these factors that go in. And mitzvot can take on historical importance. And so things are looked at. You cannot just look at the Torah with blinders on. It's meant to be lived in society, and you have to look at that. We discuss being born. It's good that we were born. And whether it's comfortable that we're born, that's a different story. Obviously, that depends on different people, but that was the debate. Between, it's Noach Lo. There is no debate that it's good to be born. Then we discussed Al Korchach, whether it's it happens, you're forced into it. We're born against our will, and we die against our wills, right? And the idea that we give judgment before God, and that's really hard. How do you fear God? Being in the presence of other people who fear God. That's the best way to do it. And that was Rav Yochanan's advice to his students, deep advice. And even though it sounds simple, like all great ideas are really, are simple ideas. You just have to plug through them. And then we discussed the introduction to the concept of numbers. Numbers are symbols, numbers are philosophy. I see somebody wrote they're both based on logic. They have numbers and philosophy. Okay, that's very good. Okay, let's see what Gershon writes. Dear Rabbi J. Chiddush on the rounding up numbers echoes this morning's podcast by Mayor Salivation, which he discussed a child in Phantom Pulbuth was 2.58. Pi, I don't know. I'm not familiar. Did you hear Salvation's podcast? No, I did not hear. So you have to tell me. No, I don't know. That pi is 3.14 or whatever. So that's interesting. Okay. All right. Any questions? You can unmute yourself. I want to wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom. Thank you. And we look forward to seeing you next week. And please invite your friends to one of the shiurim. I'm sure you have lots of friends. Just invite one or two of them to come. We got, I think, 12 shiurim next week, starting with Rabbi Nati Helfgott, part 2, Sefer Yonah on Sunday, followed by Rabbi Liebtag on Sefer Dvarim, 3 shiurim on Monday, Rebecca Winter at 11 a.m. For those who remember, she spoke one of our Tanakh series. She gave one of the Parsha shiurim. She's talking about tshuva in Tanakh. Daniel Reinhold at 1 p.m. Philosophy of Tshuva. Mark Shapiro at 8:30 on the show Lieberman, and Rabbi Adler on the Rav Soloveitchik's Rosh Hashanah. We only have one on Tuesday, two on Wednesday, Thursday. So we're keeping busy. So we look forward to learning with you and your friends, and everybody have a wonderful Shabbat and a Noach Shabbat. We should have a life. It's a wonderful thing. We should have a life that is tov. And it's good. Beit Hillel says Noach lo. It's not that we want and like that's uncomfortable. It's when Rashi was when God got mad at Yaakov. It's not that he should have a. It means he should be, have a complacent. There's a difference between comfort and complacency. It was like I want to relax. I don't want to get involved. So that you can't tell. We have to be Avram. Yes, the point of God, Rabbi Pearl was fantastic. I know that. It just will tell everybody. Okay. Shabbat Shalom. Any questions? Anybody? Yes.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.
It was wonderful as always.
Thank you.
So inspiring.
Good Shabbos.
Good Shabbos.